This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hello and thank you very much for downloading the Scotland Outdoors podcast. I'm Mark Stephen. It has been a week of enormous weather contrasts here in Scotland this week. We've had brilliant sunshine, heat waves, thunder, lightning, flooding, you name it. Anyway, this is what we're getting up to this week. Just came down from the windy city, except it isn't. There isn't a breath of wind. There's not so much as a breeze, a zephyr. If a sparrow were to cough at the moment, it would feel like a typhoon. It's just extraordinarily calm and still in the car park in Aberdeen here this morning. I'm Mark Stephen. With me today, Helen Needham.
I am struggling to sleep at night when it's like this. It's just very thick, still air, very strange. And I've noticed you've got a bit of a spring in your step this morning.
Well. We're going to be talking about wild swimming later in the programme, and I got a bit stupid, to be honest, this morning, and went down to Aberdeen Beach, probably about 4:45, something like that in the morning, and went into the water, and by gum, it fairly fires you up.
Yes. Well, I don't think it's stupid at all. Very sensible. Instant euphoria.
Indeed.
Is how it is.
Yeah.
We'd love to hear from you. Let us know what you're up to, or if you've got a particular spot you like to go for a swim. Email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, text 80295, tweet at BBC Outofdoors.
You will have noticed, of course, that Boaty McBoatface of Banffshire is not with us this morning. McElraith is off doing boaty things on the West Coast. He's been posting stuff on Twitter too, and the sunset last night was just extraordinary.
Well,
beautiful.
Feeling slightly jealous given that we've been under the cloud actually for a couple of days now, and everywhere else is sunny.
Yes, it is. It's slightly grey, but still pleasant enough here on the East Coast. Never mind. But despite the fact he's not here, we still have a mystery sound. Get your lugs around this.
No clues.
None
at all at this point. Maybe later.
Just
maybe later.
Tease people.
But if you have any idea, we like your creative ideas,
yes,
actually.
Indeed.
You can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, text 80295.
Coming up, we make contact with our go-to dolphin man, Charlie Phillips, to hear the latest in his dolphin family in the Murray Firth. And we're going to be hearing from somebody in Australia about the strong connection that he has to his native land. Now, I don't know about you, but when I've been out and about, certainly around the northeast of Scotland recently, my eye's been taken by the occasional field of what looked to me like purpley-blue flowers. I had absolutely no idea what it was, but the production team got onto the case and found Kyle Henderson, who farms near Methlick, not terribly far away from where I stay, and I asked him the fundamental question, what is this?
Phacelia. It's a mix between phacelia and red clover. The reason we're growing it is primarily because it's nitrogen fixing. So what we actually are able to do is plough it back down into the ground, and hopefully for the following crop there'll be nitrogen there so we can use less fertiliser for the next crop.
It's got these little sort of like purpley flowers, and then the stamens are incredibly long. I mean, they stick out quite a long way. I'd never seen it in the countryside before, and for some reason, I've noticed it just this year.
Yeah.
When did it come in?
So this is part of a European Union agri-environmental scheme that came in, I believe, in 2016. We signed up in 2017, and you sign a 5-year contract, and every year on your farm, part of your land has to go into this stuff, which means taking a whole year out of any other crops, so barley, wheat, etc. So we signed up primarily because we're an arable farm. We have no livestock, so
you've got no muck.
We've got no muck. The benefit being that we can plough this back into the ground, like I say, which almost acts in the same way muck does, which is, you know, nitrogen, and also gives our ground a break, which is great.
Say one thing I do notice, the number of bees in amongst this stuff.
So that's the original reason that the European Union put this scheme into place, is because obviously it is fantastic for pollinating insects. So we're not allowed to touch it between May right through until now, sort of middle of, well, near to the middle of August. And that then gives, obviously, the insects, the wildlife, the ability to use it. And although it doesn't seem too active to now, because in the last few years I've been in here and there's thousands of bees, I do actually think it really is working. I think everyone wins out of it, obviously. I think it's good for the environment, and also it's been good for our farm, so it's been great.
You get paid for doing this?
Yeah, so we actually get paid. So it's separate to our single farm payment. There's no involvement. As I said to you before, we sign up to a five-year contract, and they pay per hectare. So it's a set amount per hectare, and there will be inspections at some point, just randomly, to make sure. We have a diary that we have to fill out and adhere to. But this is what we've been advised, is we can sow any two flowering species. But the most popular, as you've noticed, is Phacelia and Red Clover. They're the two that most people seem to be using.
Are your neighbours as curious as I was?
Yeah. I've had people thought it was lavender, and, you know, they think I'm, you know...
Lavender, flax, linseed, you name it.
You name it, and they all think I'm producing something, yes. But actually all I'm doing is I'm using it to then put it back into the ground. Yeah. But yeah, luckily more and more people are doing it, so there's probably less and less questions.
Yeah, well, I must confess, it's a really attractive colour. I mean, it does kind of, it's exactly the same colour as lavender would be, French lavender or something along those lines. Yeah. Initially, I thought the red clover was actually part of the plant. I thought, wow, that is spectacular.
Yeah.
But it's nitrogen fixing, so it's doing the ground good.
Yep.
It's good for pollinating insects, not just bees.
Yeah.
It solves your problem of not having any muck because you're an arable farm.
Yep.
And you're getting paid for doing it.
Yeah.
This is a cracking crop.
I would say so. And the final thing, especially for this type of ground, because you can sort of see a low dip in the middle, and it's quite heavy clay ground. So also the benefit of this is long roots, so it breaks up the ground pretty well. Yeah. So it should help, you know, let water get away. So yeah, it's great from that point of view as well. So
I have one last question for you, and this is insider knowledge. This is equally fascinating to the flower as far as I'm concerned. What did you do before you started farming?
Yeah, I was a lawyer, 7 years ago now, I believe. Absolutely no benefit to me now, but...
Where?
I was in Australia. Yeah, I was a lawyer in Australia, so I never actually practiced or got qualified here. So it was in Perth I was, so it got to the point where either I was going to stay there forever or came home, and yeah, the pool of the farm, I think my sister got married in 2011 on the farm, came back for that, and that was it. I was like, I need to come home. Yeah, no regrets, absolutely no regrets, so it's been good.
Kyle Anderson, who's farm near Methlick in Aberdeenshire, and you can see a picture of Phacelia on our Facebook page.
I'm just thinking, actually, that ties in really nicely with the next piece that we've got, because he came home from Australia, felt the call of the land.
Uh-huh. I tell you, it's almost as if the programme was produced.
Indeed.
Almost. Scotland, as you know, is a rural country. Well, an awful lot. 98% of our land mass is rural, so it follows that we have a reasonably strong connection to the land, but perhaps not quite as strong as we think.
Recently we spoke to Daniel Browning, who's a broadcaster for the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, that's ABC. Daniel is an Aboriginal man and a sound artist.
And he explained to us just how important the connection to the land is for him and other Aboriginal people.
It's essential to you as an Aboriginal person. When you walk on your country, you feel this sense of... It's a strange feeling. I sometimes liken it to... You feel like you're a tree, and then when you land back on your country, physically you start to lay roots again. You feel connected to it, and the country kind of speaks in many different ways to you. It might be the black cockatoos with these beautiful cockatoos that are glossy and black and have red and yellow feathers. When I go home, there's always a flock of them near my country who sing me home. You know, they have this beautiful, mournful cry. The personal totem for me would be the glossy black cockatoo. You just feel this sense of I belong here, and my ancestors know this place. I know every part of that country, that little corner of the world. And you just feel like it's in your bones.
We don't have black cockatoos here, Daniel, but we've got helicopters, as you can probably hear in the background there. It's coming out of Aberdeen airports. If somebody kind of blindfolded you and dropped you in the middle of the countryside, etc., would you know instinctively when you were crossing into your own territory?
I believe so. I mean, the way I understand this whole way of being is that you feel it really keenly. And in talking to a lot of other Aboriginal people over the years and walking with them on their country, they clearly know when they've left their country. If their eyes were closed, they could tell you that I'm not in my country now. The coalescing of all those different sounds, of a different bird and a different kind of depth, and the world sounds different. And so in recording, the field recording I've done over the years, I'm always like, this is so not my country. It's so distinct from where I come from. This recording was recorded at nighttime. I'm on a bend on the Shoalhaven River, which is south of Sydney. There's a place called Bundanon, which is an artist camp, but it's a beautiful, beautiful place. Sound of the sun, the sound of the water. The different types of trees, the wind in those different types of trees. It's all about vegetation and certainly the kind of the fauna of a place. They tell you where you are.
Daniel, from what you've said so far, it seems as if actually Aboriginal culture is very, very attuned to sound, maybe more so than we are, that sound is a key part of living.
Absolutely. I mean, if you think about a genetic memory, if we have a memory, every human being alive has a genetic memory. You know, the way we perceive threat, the acuity of listening is crucial to survival. You need to know what is coming, and you need to have a sense of, like, I'm in the bush, I'm vulnerable, I'm looking for something, I'm trying to find water, I'm trying to find game to eat. And having antenna, like I like this idea that we all have antenna, and some of us use them very well, and some people are very finely tuned. It's my thing. I think I actually hear too much. But when I'm in the bush, yeah, I'm listening. I'm really kind of hearing many layers. Some of it's kind of almost subsonic. It is part of being a blackfellow, I think. You do have to know what your country sounds like in order to live off of it and to manage it well. I mean, we talk about caring for country. You know, we refer to our place as country. So my country needs me. So I am responsible for treating it well and managing it well. We also have fire management practices. We know how to use fire to burn off scrub so that there's no fuel for when a bushfire rips through. There are all these different ways of relating to country and of treating country with respect, like a human being. Yeah, I mean, it's more alive than we are, and we are just one thing in it.
Daniel Browning of ABC in Australia. And you can hear more from Daniel on the latest edition of the Scotland Outdoors podcast, which is available now on BBC Sounds and via the Out of Doors page of the BBC Radio Scotland website. Just look for the podcast section.
Coming up, I've been wild swimming in the sea, in a loch and in a river over the past week. What is your favourite place to go wild swimming? We'll be hearing about an array of wildlife in Pollock Park in Glasgow. And what about this sound then? Our mystery sound this week. Got some guesses here so far. Lil from Forest says, I think the mystery sound is the broom seed pods rattling.
Oh, that's good, Liz.
That's actually that's a good. Great sound.
It's not right, but it's good.
Yeah, it is good because last week when it was really warm and I was up on the Black Isle, I could hear it. And to start with, I was wandering through the woods thinking, what is that? There's animals everywhere. But it was the seed pods. They're I thought, I must record that at some point. And Barry? Good morning, Barry Sutherland. I'm going to have a go at the mystery sound this week. Is it moose eating a bit of food?
Again, that's a good guess.
Yeah,
but not right.
Correct.
But not correct.
So try. It's email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. Text 80295, tweet @BBCOutofdoors or get in touch via Facebook.
Last week, the results of the annual Sea Watch Foundation Whale and Dolphin Watch placed Scotland correctly top in the UK for whale and dolphin spottings. Humpbacks, orcas, dolphins were all spotted around our coasts. Joining us to tell more about all things cetacean is dolphin behavioural expert and renowned photographer Charlie Phillips. Good morning, Charlie. How are you?
Good morning, folks. How are we doing, Aberdeen?
Oh, absolutely tickety-boo, thanks. No, I mean, surely this is no great big surprise that Scotland came top of the survey.
We quite often do, to be quite honest. We have such a beautiful diversity of wildlife in our coastal seas, and also a little bit further out, it's amazing what you can come across. It's no great surprise to me, but it's just lovely to have a bit of confirmation now and again.
You're based near the Black Isle, which is a spot where you can really get close up to the dolphins of the Black Isle. Why do you think it is round there in the Murray Firth that they like to congregate there?
Bottlenose dolphins are very good at coming up with strategies for hunting, and they have been taught by their mothers for many, many, many generations that particular area is very good for tidal flows. And what they can do is they can intercept migratory salmon coming in towards the rivers where they were born. And the dolphins just sit in the incoming tide and they ambush the salmon as they come in. The dolphins use their echolocation system to detect the salmon coming towards them. And they're sitting in the tidal flow using a minimal amount of energy, and their echolocation system that they have built into their head gives the dolphin an acoustic picture of what's coming towards them, and then just at the last split second, the dolphins just move to the one side, onto the supermarket conveyor belt, as I call it, and then boom, they have a fish.
If you could describe your absolutely perfect day for going and seeing these dolphins, what would it be like in terms of the weather and so on, of day and so on?
Probably be in the late afternoon, because that's when the sun is a little bit further round at your back and it's not in your face, because Channery Point actually faces east. So from a filming and photography point of view, you actually want the sun to be a bit further round at your back. So it would be late afternoon, it would be slightly overcast, reasonably warm day without too much wind, and not too many people, but just enough people that really appreciate what they're watching in front of them. And that would, you know, for the next, you know, from low tide onwards, from the next, you know, the next 3-4 hours from low tide, it could be just absolute magic.
Someone else who's got considerable experience of observing dolphins, this time from a filmmaking point of view, is former natural history producer Sally Ann Wilson. We spoke to her recently for the Scotland Outdoors podcast, and she described some of her encounters with dolphins in various parts of the world.
I mean, I always think they're sort of swimming cows, really. People absolutely love dolphins, but they are big, blubbery animals. And yeah, and just really the way that muscle just works to get them to rip right up, particularly things like the Atlantic spinners, just watching those off places like Hawaii, where they just go up on their tails and they spin round and round. I started filming dolphins in the Murray Firth, actually, with Paul Thompson and from the Lighthouse and Cromarty, the team there, and Ben Wilson. And it was fantastic because at the time we were filming, everybody was assuming that, looking from afar, that the Murray Firth dolphins were flinging salmon around. We could see they were flinging something around, quite big. And then porpoises started getting washed up on the shores of the Murray Firth. And I think it was Harry Ross, who was the vet in Inverness at the time, at the Minavag. He said, no, come along when you're making this film. Just come along and film in the lab. And when we got to the lab, he'd got a harbour porpoise that had been battered to death, and it got great rake marks along its side. And what he did was he got out a bottlenose dolphin jawbone. And it was one of those things that I think in forensic science they called mechanical fit, as in gotcha. And the teeth marks of the bottlenose dolphin, the teeth were exactly right to fit these rakes. And they realised that it was the bottlenose dolphins that had been playing with and killing the porpoises. So that was my first experience of bottlenose dolphins. But then I had an opportunity to make a film called Kindred Spirits. And Kindred Spirits took me watching and learning about dolphins around the world, including out into Hawaii, and watching the dolphins that could respond to you by blowing bubbles to show that, you know, dolphins and language, they can learn, and to speak their name and to sort of count by blowing bubbles back. And again, that's scary to watch that sort of intelligence looking at you. And sadly, you know, these were in captivity. But my greatest fun was out filming Atlantic spotted dolphins off of the Bahamas, a tough gig. And, you know, they were just incredible because you wait for them to come to you. You don't chase them. You just drift around, and mostly the film crew sleep and sleep some more and have a drink because it's very hot. And you're sort of thinking, "How? You know, we've been out here 15 days now and we haven't seen a dolphin." And then you start seeing them. The dolphins come in, and you watch the dolphins, and they literally play with each other. They play with a bit of seaweed, and they pass it from one to the other in the pod, and they chase and they tag and they train the little ones to do the same. And then at one point the crew said, why don't you get in the water? Because we want to see what they do. Because, you know, I've had some metal mesh put in following all the surgery after I was ill. And as soon as I was in the water in my wetsuit, one of the females, one of the older females, just came up to me, and she just put her snout right against me. And she sort of went, zip, 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 zip. That's a strange looking human. That one isn't right. And clearly her echolocation picture of what these human animals should look like, she realised this one had got an extra bit. You know, what's going on here? As we would. So it's just, you know, and they are used for all sorts of things. You know, some people believe they can pick out tumours, and they just know what a human looks like inside out.
Sally Ann Wilson there. Now, it must be 20 years ago, I would imagine, Charlie, since, you know, that information came out that bottlenose dolphins in the Murray Firth were actually having a go at porpoises. I mean, there was a real shock at the time. It was as if Flipper had gone to the dark side.
Yes, I remember it very well. I've seen that happening a few times, and it still jars with you. You think, whoa, what's going on here? We have this almost ingrained vision of dolphins being friendly and cuddly and the stage of Aquarius and all the rest of it. You know? But what we must realise is that they are big, powerful, wild animals that have quite a tough life out there. And occasionally you do get behaviour that seems to go against your kind of entrenched ideas. And it just brings you back to, a little bit back up to reality again. You think, okay, so something's going on. And we really still don't quite understand what's going on. We don't. We know that it's not what we call a consumptive behaviour. The dolphins don't eat the porpoises. But what they do is they beat them up. And some of the beatings up get to such a stage where the wee harbour porpoise doesn't survive. Because you're looking at an animal that's only a third of the size of the dolphin. And the dolphins have got such a momentum behind them that when they actually swim at speed and actually knock the porpoise out of the water, you end up with broken ribs and, you know, all this kind of, you know, really serious trauma, and quite often the porpoise doesn't survive.
Charlie, you've been observing these dolphins for many years now, and you know them intimately. Can you describe some of them? Tell us about some of the characters that you've become acquainted with.
Yeah, I mean, we have Aberdeen University that's been mentioned already. They have a catalogue of identified dolphins. We identify them by the dorsal fins, the nicks and scratches that happen naturally on the dolphin's back. That's a passport photo. And so you get to, when you're studying them and filming them and photographing them, you get to know them just like individual people. And it's quite good fun to be able to know who you're looking at, because then you can actually figure out who moves around with who and what happens with who. And I mean, we've had famous characters over the years, and we still do. Lots of people come up to see the dolphins that they've adopted with the charity that I work for, Whale and Dolphin Conservation. So I can be standing on the beach and I can be showing people that support the charity dolphins like Rainbow, one of our lovely big girls who's just had a new baby, Spirit, another one of our lovely females, or we maybe have the likes of Mischief, one of the big male dolphins, who was seen last summer over in Holland. I'll talk about that later if you want, later bit. And there's also the young dolphin, Charlie, who's actually named after me. I had the great honour of having a dolphin named after me by Aberdeen University. So we've got dolphins like these, and these are local dolphins that we see nearly all the time. You can see them from Channery Point quite often. You can see them if you're out on a boat trip. And people are just blown away that you can come up and see an actual dolphin that has been photographed and has been tracked over its lifetime by the photo ID process by likes of myself, Aberdeen University, St Andrews University.
I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. But Charlie Phillips, thank you very much for joining us.
Okay, thanks, folks.
That was awful kind of you. Thank you.
We've got some correspondence here, actually.
Oh, right, go on.
Yes,
then.
About the mystery sound. And somebody's got it right.
All right, well, we can't give it out yet.
Ross and Tainault.
Well done, Ross.
Well done.
Okay, right.
And Gwen Blair says, is the noise a mouse trying to get out of a tin can?
No. No. Why would someone record that? That's just cruel.
Why not? And Sandy Main says, is it a vole moving through the undergrowth looking for food, recorded by Ewan's fancy new mini microphone? And it's Sandy Main from hot, sticky, windless, and at the moment soundless Blair Gowrie.
We're being watched.
Oh, yes, there's a herring gull, isn't there? Because I've got a special breakfast
indeed
on the table here that I'm preparing.
Yep. And as soon as you lay anything out on the table, the gulls spot it and go, what's for us?
I'm not sure they're going to be too excited about this, though. Because I said to you yesterday in our meeting, I'm going to forage a bit. Yeah. I'm going to bring some chanterelles. Uh-huh. And I went out into the woods this morning before I came here to the wee spot that we go to. And I've got a sort of a wee flavour of chanterelles here,
yes,
rather than a,
sort of a soup
an abundance.
A hint. Yes.
Yeah.
A suggestion of chanterelles. Yeah,
exactly. A suggestion of chanterelles. Some fresh parsley from the garden, a homegrown onion, and some fresh peas from the garden.
Ooh, fine.
So I'll make that
make
later.
An omelette out of that. Yeah. Fine, no bother at all. This is this week's mystery sound. I have to say, it's quite a difficult one, and we've had quite a few suggestions so
far.
Yeah,
which I'm enjoying. I quite like it when it's a difficult one and people have to go into the deep depths of their imagination to figure out what it is. So Katie in Perth says, a stoat or a weasel chittering?
Yeah, good guess. No.
Mags in Argyle says, sounds like lots of wee brown birds having a dust bath.
Again, yeah, good idea.
Mary Frame in Gifford says, is it a squirrel burying a nut?
Do they actually make a noise when they bury a nut?
Well, they must do. Of course they do.
Well, I'm scrabbling noises, but do they talk to themselves? I don't
maybe.
Know. Absent-mindedly saying, oh, when did I leave that nut?
We'll have this later. Mardy in Edinburgh says, good morning, someone washing their hands and scrubbing their nails?
Nope. No, I'm not even sure I could make that explanation out of that noise, but never mind.
Ian Quinn says house martins in the nest.
Ah, yeah, it's pretty close.
And another one here, Keith in Hertfordshire says, is your mystery bird a coltit? No.
No.
It's not.
Yeah. In fact, we're going to go one step further at this stage in the programme and say it's not a mystery bird.
It's not a bird. There's the first clue.
There's the first clue.
We say no more.
That's
but
it.
You can get
all you're getting.
We're
just teasing.
Yeah, teasing. Outofdoors at bbc.co.uk. Text 80295. Tweet at BBC Outofdoors or get in touch via Facebook.
With Helen Bean here today, we thought we'd revisit a fabulous trip we took together back in 2013 when we climbed my favourite mountain in the north. Well, in fact, anywhere in Scotland, never mind the northwest, Sullivan.
I think what was so special about it was how we went about it. And never once for the conventional approach.
No. And this really appealed to us because we got the chance to paddle in from Elphin by kayak before climbing the south side of Sullivan, all in the capable hands of Erin Bastian and Julianne McLeod of Norwest Sea Kayaking.
So we're going to have yourself in the Aquanaut HV.
Okay.
Okay.
Does H stand for heavy by any chance?
Huh? High volume.
That wasn't funny.
I think we're going to try you in the Capella, Helen, actually.
Orange is my favourite colour, so I'm quite pleased
about
that.
Oh, that's good. That's good. As long as you've got one that's the right colour. Yes, good. Well, that's us out in the water now. And immediately it's just got very, very quiet. It's lovely. The scenery is just, it's so beautiful round about here. I mean, we're getting a much better view of Sullivan now. That's at Coolmore over there.
Yes, Coolmore on the left.
Okay.
And Sullivan appearing on the right.
Got a fantastic pinnacle on the ridge there, which would be what? That would be the west ridge?
Yes, the western ridge of Coolmore.
Yeah.
Yeah, very steep-sided. Mm-hmm. So when you're at the coast and you look up at Coolmore, it looks very steep. Yeah. Slightly friendlier from this side.
Yeah. We were talking recently about the Cairngorms as being very soft, very feminine hills and what have you, you know, certainly in shape. Like, I think that the expression was, you know, like a tray of Bath buns. These aren't anything like it.
These are improbable. I think someone has said that, actually. It could have been Norman McCaig that said that. But that Sullivan in particular, you just look at it and think, where on earth did that come from? How did that happen?
They're isolated sandstone peaks. So if you can imagine, this whole valley would have been 6 kilometres deep in sandstone. So sandstone is a sedimentary rock, which means it erodes pretty easily. So the glaciers were able to come and gouge out the valleys here. The glaciers left these isolated peaks, which are the sort of magic of Ascent and Coigiach.
There's a short section of river between Lough Fiatty and Lough Fian. And you can hear how shallow it is. Oh, well. Stuck. Yeah, I'm going to have to come out. Bit of a blow, but there we go. Whoop. Oh, no. Ah, so near and yet so far. Yeah, I'm just soaked from the waist down, that's all. And I have to say, that's quite refreshing having a damp dope. Onwards.
Oh, chill.
It's the cold water that's the best, basically, isn't it?
Oh, fresh air.
Yeah. We kind of climbed up from the loch side and thankfully into an area where there's just a smidgen of a breeze because it was breathless down there. No movement of the air at all, and just like an oven. But where we're standing now, you'd almost think that was man-made. It's like some sort of Inca temple because the rock naturally forms blocks and the frost splits it and it falls off in blocks. It's really quite impressive.
This is the most amazing thing about this mountain, isn't it? That the closer you get, the more you see, and it changes all the time. Mm-hmm. That you realise all those columns.
Yeah, that's roughly what it is. It's obviously been laid down over successive periods of time. And you can see where the glaciers successively have come along, lower and lower and lower, and scoured it away, which is why you get these terraces.
you know, it's even pleasant just standing beside this stream.
Yeah, just listening to it's good.
Maybe Erin calls this the goat path because you have to be a bit of a mountain goat to negotiate it. It's pretty steep coming up the south slopes of Sulven here, but we're being rewarded by astonishing views. Stack Polly right in front of us, and actually things are opening up a lot. Can see out to the sea. And this is the point in the walk where everyone just goes at their own pace and you kind of find your own rhythm, really.
It's a wall. I could have sworn that was a geological feature. Who the hell built that up here?
It is the most incongruous thing to have a perfectly formed, dry, stained dike in the middle of this mountain.
It's a beautiful piece of building. It's about 3-4 feet wide at the base. It probably stands about 4.5 feet high. It's got capstones on it. If you built that down in level ground, you'd be thinking you did well. The 2,000 feet up here, plus. It's just fabulous to be up here. The sun is coming in underneath the cloud, which means that the lacework pattern of lochs and lochans off to our left looks like beaten silver. Beautiful. And all the more evocative because you're actually looking at it through a mist. And off to the north there, you can see the sun shining through the mist, but it's just an infinity of Scotland.
Well, I'm going to get into the bag because I've got the wee hip flask.
Oh, God bless you, Tiny Tim. Good health. We're just walking up to the edge now, and we're just on the edge of the weather. So there's big, dirty grey clouds actually just slightly below us and dotted round about. But everywhere else is clear, so out to sea, out to the Hebrides, it's golden. And then you get these spits of land, and then the wee lochs that we were paddling on earlier, they've gone molten. Mm. It's wonderful.
It really is, and that's the distinguishing feature of Ascent, isn't it? Water.
Water. Water, water everywhere, absolutely.
It's not a walk in the park, this hill.
No.
That's for sure. It's not. It's,
no, not at all.
It may not be in Munro, but it's still, it's very steep, but my goodness, it's worth it.
Yeah. No, I mean, I genuinely had doubts about halfway up, because I thought, I'm absolutely puckled for this. And then since we got onto the saddle, or possibly just when it started raining, I kind of got a second wind and it was okay. But this has really been a revelation to me in how adaptable the kayaks actually are. What awaits us now is a night's camp, wee bonfire possibly.
And those rocks down the way. It's all very well going up, but...
Yeah, yeah. I really enjoyed that trip, but boy, the cramp I got that evening.
Yeah.
The leg just locked.
Yeah.
But no, it was fabulous. I mean, it's such a wonderful way to actually get to a hill.
Yeah,
by sea kayak.
A real adventure. I'm just going to say that music, because we have been brought up on this before, that we should acknowledge the musicians. That was Myrid Green, who is herself a Coigach lass.
All right, okay.
And the track there is called Full Tilt Jigs from her album Passing Places. And I chose that because I thought it was appropriate given she was local.
Indeed.
We have some correspondence. Actually, we've been talking about swimming. We're going to be talking about swimming quite soon. Max says, always amused when I hear of people going wild swimming. When we were young, we just went for a duke.
Yes, you're right, Mac. It was swimming in the old days.
Scented Forager, which is Fee, says, my Gladstone bag, which I think is her husband, Stephen, swims in South US West Coast. I am less brave. My tip is to seek out tidal beaches, e.g. South Glendale or Valley on North US, where the water is a tad shallow but warmer. Mm-hmm. And this one sort of combines the two. This is Keith Dolan. He says, morning, Mark and Helen. I hope you are well. Yes, we are.
Yes, we are. Thank you for asking.
I thought I'd have a guess at the mystery sound. I wasn't sure, but then Mark mentioned going for a sea swim before the show. It instantly came to me. It was Mark trying to get into his wetsuit. Ha ha.
Well, that's a lot noisier than that. I didn't have one this morning.
Yeah, and actually people are starting to get that sound.
Good. Right. Fine. We'll have a list.
Yep. A couple of quick other ones here. John in Leven in Fife says, wild swimming. I walk 50 yards from my house in Leven to swim in the crystal clear Forth nearly every day, bobbing about overlooking Largo Bay, watching the terns and gannet fish and the occasional flock of ring plover flying above my head. So good for well-being.
Absolutely.
Oh, that sounds brilliant, doesn't it?
Yeah, too straight. We've had some just fantastic weather over the past week and some absolutely terrible weather at the same time. During the hot spell, Wednesday? Wednesday was just blisteringly hot. The appeal of having a duke in a loch or river or sea, so many people took the opportunity to do it. There's lots of pictures on social media of folk doing just that. And you've had a go at this too.
Well, I said earlier, I've been in the sea, I've been in Loch Ness, I've been in the River Dee, so I thought I would share my enthusiasm for the water with everyone else, with a little help from my children. When I conceived the idea of recording a wild swimming piece for this programme, I was enjoying an idyllic summer break on the Black Isle, where every day was a swimming day.
I tried to float, but it didn't really work out, but it kind of worked out, and then I got to pick up some of the squelchy stuff, because when the tide was in all the way, my brother could get the squelchy stuff and throw it at me, but I couldn't.
We had to take our sandals off because we were at risk of getting stuck, but when you went in bare feet, it was really good.
And quite unlike any feeling I've had before. It was like slime, which you would think would be really unpleasant, but there was something pleasant about having it between your toes.
Yeah, it felt quite soothing, actually.
I had a really good time, then I spent there for a while, and then I got really warm, and then I felt like I don't want to go out, but we're going to go back to our friend's house. And it felt really sad, because I wanted to stay inside, because it was really nice.
Just floating on the gentle lapping waves of the Beauly Firth with your arms outstretched, staring up at the clouds. Back at home, everything changed because of this. And the prospect of swimming in our local river didn't seem quite so appealing. With the best of intentions, I came down to the riverbank a couple of days ago after the storm, and that was the day when it was really, really hot, bizarrely hot after that big storm. And I thought, it's warm, I'll jump in and have a swim. Took one look at the river and thought, I'm not going anywhere near that because it was high and very, very fast. A day later, and actually it's amazing how quickly the level can change. It's almost gone down to normal, but the colour, it's very, very peaty, and it's almost a ginger, actually, when I look at that water. The pace has slowed since yesterday, thankfully. Not quite the hot, sunshiny day that I would normally embrace the waters of the River Dee, but for the sake of my art, I'm going to do it. Oh, it's not as bad as I thought, actually. And the further in I go, the darker the water appears. Reaching knees now. It's always the certain parts of the body where it reaches. I'm not going to go into any more detail. And that's the key point. The question is, do you take the quick plunge or do you ease yourself in slowly? There is definitely a softness to this water, and I always like to think that it's something to do with its journey from the Cairngorm Mountains. And by entering the river, I'm embracing the spirit of the mountains. That's the little child. I think she's a bit concerned. There we go. My skin is tingling, but in the nicest possible way, and I never ever regret going into the water. But I just have to do one more thing because I haven't fulfilled the full task of a river swim, which is you haven't done a proper wild swim unless you put your head under the water. Surprisingly refreshing.
How did you record that?
I employed the services of my partner.
You stand up to your neck in the water and then...
Well, he only had shorts on and I was going further in and he was standing there saying, I've got my phone in my pocket.
Give it to the kids.
It wouldn't be the first time we'd lost the phone in that river.
No,
anyway.
Sure. Right.
Yes.
Anyway, that was you taking the plunge in the River Dee. If you are thinking of taking a dip out and about, pick a safe spot. Philip Hoare is an author who writes about the sea in Wales, and he's a man who swims in the sea every day of his life, and he joins us now from Southampton. Can I take it, Philip? Good morning, by the way. Can I take it that you've actually been out for your dip already?
I have indeed, yes. In the dark, early hours of the morning. I mean, this week actually has been rather wonderful because your listeners probably know, I'm sure they do, that it's the... The Perseid meteorites has been this week. So I've been swimming sort of about 3 o'clock in the morning with these falling stars falling into the sea. And at the same time, remarkably, the sea is actually bioluminescent at the moment. So there's these tiny zooplankton called dinoflagellates, which spark at your fingertips. So actually there are stars in the sky and actually stars in the sea as well.
Wonderful. Absolutely lovely.
And when I was speaking to you yesterday, you said that sometimes you feel like an astronaut when you're out there in a situation like that.
Yeah, I tweet every day about my swims, and yesterday I tweeted I felt as though I was floating away and someone had cut the cord. I don't even remember the film 2001 where one of the astronauts he flies off into space, sort of like, and that sense of complete. I mean, and it's scary because, you know, and I, as you say, I do not advise listeners to swim in the dark. I only do it because I know this water as well as I know my own body, and I really know what I'm doing. But so it is dangerous, and don't do it unless you really know what you're doing. But at the same time, that sense of being suspended from gravity in this element, which is already like the sky, it's really interesting, Helen, you talk about how the river is being, you're being in the mountain. And that sense of being within nature, physically part of it. So in the water, you are physically part of nature. It's one reason why I find whales really interesting is because they're very social animals. Anyone who's seen orca around the coasts of Scotland will know that these animals are tightly bound as social animals. And that's partly because they feel one another in the water. They feel one another in sound, but they are almost physically connected by the water. And I think that's what, for us, as you know, I don't like the term wild swimming in a way, because it sort of commodifies it in a way. It's swimming. But I think one of the things why we do like swimming, and why, you know, that report from the River Dee is so powerful to anyone, is because it's the first sound we ever heard through our mother's bellies, the amniotic fluid in our mother's bellies. That's how we first experience the world, is through a salty little mini sea.
It's interesting you should say that, because I was just thinking, I think I'm correct in saying that the salinity of the sea is roughly equivalent to the salinity of human blood. And it is a bit like being cocooned again, a bit being back in the womb, you know. And I have swum in the dark, wonderfully one time in Africa, in a lake there. And the lake was, I don't know, must have been about 20 degrees. And there was a thunder and lightning storm going on just at the edge of the lake, you know. And I was floating again. It just, this is an infinity of stars above you, and then just these flashes of light and this long delay of the thunder coming towards you. There's something fabulously elemental about it, and really invigorating. And I'm not sure why it's so invigorating.
Well, isn't it because I think, like, most of us spend our lives now behind a blue screen, which is an artificial one. And suddenly you're in this real blue screen, which you can swim through. And you are, I mean, I like the fact that I actually quite like the dangerousness of it. That actually every swim is like a little death in a way, because you are daring yourself.
Hopefully not.
Well, no, exactly. But there is this sense of, it's where we came from and it's where we might end up. And of course, from an evolutionary point of view, I mean, it is where we came from. So this is kind of atavistic memory of the water as our home as organisms.
So you go swimming every single day of your life. How long have you been doing this for? And when did you realise that actually this was a really positive thing for you personally to have in your life as part of your routine?
Well, I didn't learn to swim until I was 30, even though I was born and brought up in the place I'm talking to you from now, Southampton. I still live in the same house. Hear the sound of the foghorns. I'm about a mile away from the sea. But I was really apprehensive, really scared of it as a boy. My parents were older. My dad was born in the First World War. I mean, he was, you know, they had me when they were old. So my father had been born in Bradford. He never learned to swim. I felt very scared of the water, with good reason, but also sort of pathologically so for me. So it wasn't until I was living in London in the 1980s I actually, to address this malfunction of myself, I went to a local swimming bars, and this elderly lady, she was certainly in her 80s, and in her swimsuit, which was boned, you know, like a corseted swimsuit. Rubber hat with daisies on it, you know. Uh-huh. And she took pity on me. I went to a monastery school. My PE teacher at school was a former army sergeant major. His way of teaching us to swim was to push us in the deep end, and you know. So, but this woman, she saw my apprehension. She empathized with me, and she sort of adopted me. She saw me as a sort of as a case to be corrected. And she taught me that, she taught me the vital thing in it, and Helen, you talk about it in that piece, is like putting your head in the water, breaking that membrane, that scary barrier between yourself and another world. And that's what did it for me, is realizing that it actually isn't full of monsters which are going to grab and drag you down, that it's actually a wonderful, beautiful place.
I was off Aberdeen Beach this morning, as I said, and you know, it wasn't quite light yet. You know, and you could see all the supply vessels moored off, because they're known as taxi ships, because, you know, once they get a shout, once they get a job, they come into harbour, pick up the stuff, and then off they go again. So, I mean, I was confident I was going to be the only person on the beach. Somebody else turned up with a skateboard. And then as I was climbing the stairs to get back up to my car, there were two young women who were coming down, and they had those enormous robes on, you know, basically dressing gowns on steroids that people who go regularly swimming seem to wear these days. The question that I suppose everybody will want to know is, when you go swimming every day in life, wetsuit, no wetsuit, what do you do?
Nothing.
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 Nothing at all.
Fully communing with
fully
nature.
Fully communing with nature. Frighten the seagulls.
But, you know, I have to cycle to the sea. It takes me, you know, 10 minutes or so. So cycling in a wetsuit isn't a good idea. and the wetsuits, they're sort of sweaty. They're completely opposite to what you want to feel when you're in the water. You want to feel, you know, Baudelaire, the poet Baudelaire in the 19th century wrote about of swimming as being kissed 1,000 times a minute. Uh-huh. You don't feel that in a wetsuit. Plus, I was shocked. The first time I put a wetsuit on, the people I was swimming with, they said, you know, it's, well, obviously to keep yourself warm, you pee in it. I thought, so that's another reason why I don't like wetsuits.
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't mind, but you borrowed it. Yeah. Philip, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you as ever. Thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Philip Hoare, who goes swimming every day in life.
Yeah, and actually...
In the buff.
We didn't even get time to ask him about when he goes swimming in freezing cold waters off,
exactly.
Off New England. He told me yesterday that his feet actually got frozen to the beach one day. Amazing.
Oh, bare feet?
Yes.
Wow. Okay.
Get in touch. Tell us your favourite swimming spots. Email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. Text 80295 or tweet at BBC Out of Doors. We're also going to be talking about allotments shortly, actually. It's National Allotment Week. So how does your allotment grow? What have you been growing and harvesting? I've got some peas here that I've brought along for the breakfast that I'm going to make later.
Our supper last night was homegrown cauliflower cheese. Well, not the cheese, obviously, but the cauliflower. And a type of tatty that I've planted, and I couldn't remember what it was. And Fiona, our producer today, confidently tells me it's fir pinks.
Pink fir.
Pink fir.
Yes.
Well, if I don't hit it, I stagger it. Right. But it's they were tasty tatties, but I think they might be a salad potato. I'm not sure, because I kind of half-cooked them through the brie and the skins fell off.
Yeah. Quick text here. Colin and Mary Abercrombie, they say, morning. Thanks for putting on a great show every week. We are currently undertaking the coast-to-coast walk from St. Bees to Robin Hood's Bay.
Ooh.
We had four absolutely roasting days in the lakes and are now in the Yorkshire Dales before going through North York Moors. A wonderful journey.
Beautiful.
Quite interested in that.
Yeah, a bit nice, that.
Yeah.
Anyway, our lockdown exercise piece this week comes from Glasgow-based journalist and broadcaster Paul English. Paul's been out and about a lot on his bike recently, and he's been a regular visitor to Pollock Park, along with his sister Wendy.
Hello again.
Hello. How are you?
All right. Shall we go and look and see what we can see?
Mm-hmm.
Many visits do you think you've made here now?
How many days have we been in lockdown?
Too many. Four months. May up March.
High double figures, because certainly at the start of lockdown, the first few months, I was here every day, sometimes twice a day, sometimes for 6 hours in the day, later on when you were allowed out longer.
So this is a place you took me to maybe about week six or seven in Pollock Park, and it's down by the mountain bike trails, which, to be quite honest, I'd never really paid that much attention to. I always just come into Pollock Park on my bike and sort of whizzed around the perimeter, but this is absolutely brilliant. Even as we're down here tonight, there's kids down taking in the tracks.
Yep.
But this was a spot that you took me to because
I became a bit of a part of a bird watching fraternity in the park during lockdown, and while I was at the site of a woodpecker nest, a guy appeared with a large lens to tell me I was at a woodpecker nest, and I told him it fledged, and he said to me, "Have you seen the buzzards?" And I was very excited, and he described where the buzzards were, and I promptly headed down there with a new friend that I've made in the woods during lockdown, who's a fellow bird watcher, and we watched these buzzards chicks basically grow from grey, fluffy, scraggy looking things to beautiful brown full feathered grown buzzards in the middle of a city park.
In the middle of the park. You took me to that. I've been down maybe about six or seven times since then, and last week I came down and both the buzzards, well, certainly one of the buzzards was on the nest, but it was out on a limb as well, and it actually, we thought we saw it fledging because it took flight and, you know, flew around, and then but then it came back to the nest. You were telling me that that's something that they do.
Well, what you'll get is once they fled, they will be around the adults for another 6 weeks, but they'll only have a range in the park of you know, not a huge range, so yeah. they will be within this range, and just further over from that, from the nest that we have been watching them on, there are a couple of other nests. And sometimes they'll come back to the same nest every year, but sometimes they do change. So one of these other nests that's close by could have been last year's nest.
All right, well, and so it's a case of look out next year then.
Yeah, definitely. They might come back to the same nest, or they might use one of these other nest sites, because I don't imagine there's another pair in such close proximity, because they'll have their own range in the woods.
One of the great things, it's not only been a discovery for me to see this buzzard's nest, which we're now looking at, and there doesn't appear to be any buzzards on, but
that would be right.
Also seeing the activity that's going on off the beaten track in the woods. I mean, there's now about four or five people down here on the cycle track, and I think that's been one of the discoveries for me, is actually seeing this place kind of with new eyes. And it's been on both your doorstep and my doorstep for, well, 20 years.
Yeah, it's a place I always came to do my exercise, but during lockdown, because I didn't have any urge or rush or any pressure work-wise or socially, I could just come into the park and be and indulge myself in what was already a favourite pastime of bird watching. But
you saw a whole lot, didn't you? It wasn't just the buzzards and the wood. I saw a woodpecker here one night. Just yeah. Didn't hear it, but saw it, and it was amazing because we stood and watched it for about 5 minutes.
Yeah,
you saw all sorts.
Yeah, I became kind of known as a person that could take you on a bird safari.
Yeah.
At one point, I brought several people here to see these buzzards, but. Right at the height of spring, found lots of blue tit nests, great tit nests, woodpeckers, nuthatches, which obviously I've always been here, but I've never had the time or just really was in that headspace to sit and think it's spring. And also the lack of traffic. Once you got used to listening for calling chicks,
yep.
Then you heard it all the time, and I found especially blue tits and great tits nesting in all sorts of strange places, in the walls of Pollock House and in a fence post, a metal hollow fence post, and it was really wonderful, really wonderful.
I felt it became quite a sanctuary to me. It was kind of like a safe harbour, but it's rooted right in the middle of the city. And where I'm going to push on to after this is I discovered a little route out of here that takes you onto the National Cycle Network. And that loops you out into a 60-kilometre route, which can take you all the way out into the middle of Lanarkshire. You're tracking motorways, you're going through the kind of urban sprawl, but you're in the undergrowth and you're out in the countryside, and it's right here in the city.
Yeah, I think I met a lot of people, a bit like myself, during lockdown, who veered off of the main paths in Pollock Park to probably primarily get away from other people and try and be socially distanced. But in doing so, you know, my knowledge of my bird calls and wildflowers and trees is very much better than it was at the start. And I've also now met lots of people that often you might be out doing your walk at the same time as other people. So you made new acquaintances in the park who were very much seeking solace the same way that you were in the greenery. Not just round the paths, but actually in the woodland.
And you can hear the roar of the traffic. I mean, there is a motorway at the other side of this park, and there are some pretty major kind of, you know, arterial roads, but you couldn't hear that at certain points. It was really silent.
Yeah, right at the start, in the first week of lockdown, that was very, very apparent. Very apparent. And also when I started to use the golf course to walk on and yeah. like kind of exercise on the golf course and then come and sit in the woods, the absence of the noise of traffic was really quite marked at the start, but you did hear it creep up.
And you taught me the difference between a willow warbler and a chiff-chaff.
Indeed, and you can now spot a few birds yourself. And that was the main kind of bonding over the new friend that I made in the woods. She wasn't really very up on her bird call at all, so I was kind of her living encyclopedia of bird song.
Yeah.
And I'm by no means an expert, but I'm very much better than your average person who might just say, there's a bird.
Yeah.
So, and it's been a real joy, I have to say, and it's been lovely to share it with other people as well.
Forest bathing.
Indeed, forest bathing. But do you know what? We've always loved it, and it's really where we come from, really, isn't it? We didn't evolve in concrete boxes. We evolved in moorland and woodland and seaside. And I mean, it's such a great park, and really, you can, apart if you can zone out the noise of the traffic. you really do get the feeling of being, you know, in the woods, yeah. In the deep, dark woods.
Wendy and Paul English at Pollock Park in Glasgow.
She's just a wonderful example of somebody that's had a complete revelation over lockdown.
Absolutely.
And just tuned into what's going on around. It's great to hear.
This has come in from Ivor and Kate Fennell. Email said, good morning, we love listening to your show. Today we are climbing Cairnan Turk and Cairnan Clace in Glenshee. These are our first Munro in 7 years and first hike out since last year. We're really looking forward to it. We're listening to the show en route from our home in Edinburgh. Well, I hope you have a lovely day.
Yeah, have a great time. And Leslie in Edinburgh says, morning from Edinburgh. We're heading to Banff for a break later today. We'll be visiting Colliston Beach, the Eithin and Newburgh, among other places, following your recommendations. I've been looking forward to asking Ewan to leave one of his gourmet picnics at the gate of BBC Banff for me to pick up on the way past, so I'm less than impressed that he has shot off west. Any other places you'd recommend to see? We have a week. Love the show.
Hackley Bay. Hackley Bay, which is between Colliston and Forvey. Between Colliston and Newburgh, basically. You'll find it on the map, and it's a lovely wee secluded bay.
Have a lovely time, Leslie.
Indeed. Barry Sutherland, Yorkshire, says, I have a few questions. I'm only going to read this first one, Barry. Is Ewan listening, and would he know what the mystery sound is? How am I supposed to know, man?
The love of goodness.
I can't read his mind. I wouldn't want to read his mind. You're listening to Out of Doors here on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen. She's Helen Needham. If you miss any of this, there are a few ways of listening again.
You can catch up whenever you like by looking the programme up on BBC Sounds.
Or you can download the free Scotland Outdoors podcast, which is available from BBC Sounds. It's an excellent app. We love hearing where you listen. You can email us your stories at outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, which is what Paul and Debbie Main did. And Paul says, this is interesting. My wife Debbie and I started listening to your show a few years ago from Luton in Bedfordshire. It's become a regular weekly fixture in our lives, albeit often on Sounds due to its early kickoff.
The reason for my email, though, is to especially thank you for one of your Scotland Outdoors podcasts. It was the one featuring Philippa Forrester, and she mentioned she'd done an ecology degree. That got me thinking and led me to applying and being accepted to study for a Master's in Sustainable Mountain Development at the University of Highlands and Islands, which I start in September. A bit of a departure from my current job as an accountant in London.
That's just excellent. He goes on to say, without that podcast, I doubt I would have signed up for these studies, which can hopefully lead to career change and making a positive contribution to the environment. So thank you very much. This week, we will be listening en route to our fortnight's family holiday in Torridon. Keep up the great work, Paul Main. Superb. Coming up shortly, we'll reveal what is making this noise.
Quite a lot of people getting this right now.
Good.
Yep, but some not. Peter in Ochterada says, is it a beaver? Lynn says...
We've got to get a recording of a beaver. We really do. That's about the third
every
request.
Week, yeah.
Every week.
And Lynn says, is it the sound of a beaver chewing on a tree?
No.
Not heading out today, but did Ben Vorlich at Loch Lomond yesterday. It was hot, hot, hot. Even hotter on the summit than at sea level.
Wow.
Had a wee wild swim in the loch when we got back down again. Sylvan on my list for next year. Go for it.
Whatever I do. This week, as I'm sure you're only too aware, is National Allotment a Week, and it's easy to see why our allotments are more popular than ever. Growing your own food, getting some outdoor exercise, fresh air, learning new skills are just some of the benefits. Joining us now is fellow BBC Radio Scotland presenter and fairly recent allotment gardener, a bit of a tyro really, Nicola Meehan. Good morning, Nicola.
Good morning. How are you both? It's lovely to be chatting. I'm usually down the allotment by this time now in my new life as an allotmenteer. But before that, Mark Stephen, I cannot believe that you were in Bridgevallen a mere couple of days ago and you didn't come round for a cup of tea.
Well, I would have done, but I was visiting my daughter at the time. Actually, it wasn't a cup of tea you were suggesting, it was a pint. And I would have got pelters if I'd gone to the pub.
Anyway. I bet you thought you could come to the village and not. I knew about it straight away. I bumped into Liz on her way to chat to you about bats. That's where we live. Anyway,
Everybody, tell us about your allotment.
Well, I tell you what, basically, a couple of years back now, my wee boy and I all kind of walk down a certain part of the road where you can see the allotments. They're really close to us, 5 minutes away. They're council allotments. And he'd said, could we get one at some point? Because in our old house, we used to grow, you know, potatoes and beetroot, very basic stuff. But we tried. So I went on the list. And of course, because there is this list, you never know if or when you're going to get one. And then round about my birthday last year, we got given the keys. So mm-hmm. my husband paid up. I told him that was my birthday present. And that was the start of it. But to be honest, in the beginning, there was just a lot of weeding to be done. It was a plot. It's a half plot. And it was about 8 foot high with hogweed and raspberries and all sorts of wild bushes. So we had a lot of kind of sort of jungle-like adventures trying to cut everything down. Then we just chucked a tarpaulin on it and we didn't really start on it until March, which of course coincided with the lockdown, which gave us lots of time to, just start working on it bit by bit. John built up beds, I would plant them. So we did a corner at a time and I cannot imagine what the last few months would have been like without it, to be honest. It's been quite life-changing in kind of lovely, quiet ways, having it.
I'm sure lots of people feel the same. I know that I've got really into gardening over the past few months. In fact, I'm just pod-shelling some peas here.
Indeed.
That I picked from the
there you go.
The garden this morning. What have you been growing then, Nicola? What's been a success? What hasn't worked quite so well?
Well, I tell you what, the first thing I have to tell you about, Helen, because you know I am a prolific consumer of chamomile tea, and we've
yes.
chatted about this
yes.
a lot in the past.
Have you
I've got loads
some?
Of chamomile
Brilliant.
Growing, loads of it. So eventually I will have my own chamomile flowers. So that was top of the list, as you can imagine. And on that front, you know, lots of herbs. I've got a little polytunnel and it smells absolutely brilliant. There's everything from fennel and lemon verbena to peppermint to also borage and all sorts of lovely kind of some exotic, some very basic. It's good to have basil and things in the actual beds themselves. Everything you can imagine from the staples. But I have to say, see with the staples, I bought it all in rainbow. So it's kind of technicolour vegetables. We've got pink potatoes, we've got yellow stripy beetroot, I've got rainbow chard, which I adore, of course, purple broccoli. And a lot of our vegetables have been given to us by people on fellow allotments, which has been one of the loveliest things. We were barely there and we're being handed Brussels sprout plants and celery plants, strawberries, pumpkins, and there's stories with all of them as well. So you get the food and you get the veg and you get the company. But you also get the solitude, which is lovely as well.
I wanted to ask you about this community idea, because I think most folk have got this concept, or rather rosy concept, of allotment life as being, you know, it's a bit like being cast in the Wombles. You know, it's wonderful. You know, people are lovely to you and things like that. Is it always like that?
Well, certainly in my experience so far,
oh, you
I am new,
me.
And I suppose if you wanted to,
dark news somewhere, you know, but
I might get the gossip. Yeah, but so far it's been, and also I would say I tend to go down. It's always quiet, but I go down now early in the morning. So it's me and I mentioned this on a pack on the Friday afternoon show recently. There's a lovely man called Arnie who has strawberry runners that date back, it seems to be forever. And he brings me down strawberries if I'm there early and we have a bit of a chat. But it's kind of quiet conversations at the moment rather than kind of neighbourly rammies, Mark. But I will keep you posted on that. Maybe
it'll
get a bit more high octane.
And what do you think it's done? I mean, there's obviously the physical aspect of gardening, but what's it done for you and what have you observed, the positive impacts mentally?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I think for John, my husband, who, you know, we've been on chatting about the Wallace Monument and things like that on the show before, and he really, you know, the manual labour's been good for him, but on a physical and a psychological level. I think for me, a lot of it's just the kind of peace of it, the kind of going down, it's super quiet, you hear the birds. There's always something to be done, but it's never a chore. It's always in your own time. And I think also there's a sort of inherent sense of optimism and hope, isn't there, in planting anything, and maybe particularly in planting kind of plants and flowers and things that you can actually eat at the end of it. So you have this kind of idea that, you know, we'll just wait and see what happens. There's also the element of surprise, which I love, because I haven't really labelled anything. I'm not a very methodical gardener, to say the least. So there's a lot of seeds which we'll wait and see what they are, you know. So I like the element of excitement as well. Mystery.
Going back to what you were talking about beforehand, I saw a lovely idea a few years ago, and it was a bench that was made out of wicker, you know, or growing willow, you know, so it's planted on the ground, it grows in itself, and it was filled with soil, and then they planted chamomile on the top of it, so that when you sat on it, you got this perfume of chamomile rising. It was an incredibly
calming place to
be.
That's it, exactly. I think, you know, touching on the kind of sense of the smells as well, and also you get the bees around you, so there is this completely different aura, I suppose. And I should say, these are allotments that are literally 2 minutes off one of the main roads in Bridge of Allen. You turn down this pathway and it's like another world. And of course, some of them have been there for years and they are magical places. So it's inspiring as well, but it's great fun.
Nicola, as ever, it's been a great pleasure speaking to you. Thank you. Thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
All right.
Have a good weekend.
Yeah, right, and enjoy your allotment.
I will do. Cheers.
See ya. You can hear Nicola on Radio Scotland on Friday afternoons from 2 to 4 p.m.
Right, I think it's time to reveal the mystery sound, isn't it?
Aye, it's this funny little sound we've been plaguing you with throughout the show.
Well, actually, lots of people got it right, so I'm just going to run through some of the names that I have here. I'm sorry if I've missed you out. Neil in Glasgow, correct, it is a...
It's a bat colony.
Yeah.
It's a bat colony.
Tony says bats, and also says he's just on the way to the beach, not far from where the Arctic Terns fly 10,000 miles annually to come and stay with us. Callum and Bucky says it's got to be a bat having a chat. Mm-hmm. My Gladstone bag says it's bats nesting, probably not in a belfry, possibly a roof or a cave.
It was a roof. It was a roof. We were down staying with friends just the other day down near Glasgow. And came out and John said, oh, a tremendous number of bats we've got at the moment. I've no idea where they're coming from. We walked out the house and I said, there, that's where they're coming from, that spot there. And it's just that, you know, they've got like a front porch and the eave, you know, there were two spots where they were actually flying out there. And I said to him, this is a fantastic sound, you know, go and get me a long pole. And we sellotaped the microphone to the pole and actually managed to record this. I didn't know what type of bat it was, so I decided to find out more from Liz Ferrell of the Bat Conservation Trust.
So it's pipistrelle bats. And I know that just from experience of listening to a lot of bat roosts. I do a lot of home visits before pandemic times, you know. Yeah, I would go to people's houses quite often and would hear that noise within their walls and as they were emerging. So our most common bats to be roosting in people's houses.
This might be a daft question, but why was I able to hear that at my age?
I'm sorry, I wish you could say your hearing was perfect.
Exquisite, but no.
Yes, but no, it's what we call their social calls. Uh-huh. So the social calls are very different from their echolocation calls. It's the echolocation calls that we can't hear that's above our hearing range, so we need the bat detectors to be able to bring their echolocation calls down into our hearing range below 20 kilohertz, and if you're a wee bit older, maybe a wee bit less as well. So the social calls are within our hearing range, so below 20 kilohertz, and it's just their social chatter. Maybe they're a bit annoyed, another bat's got a bit too on top of the other, maybe it's particularly hot in the roost, or it's just general communication chatter.
What would the roost inside the roof void look like? You know, because I mean, you have this image of bats hanging upside down and things, but you mean, I've seen bats on things, and they're totty wee things, about the size of an old-fashioned matchbox.
Yeah, exactly, a great comparison to make, about kind of small matchbox size, you know, easily fit on a credit card, and they'll cram into wee tight spaces, particularly the pipistrelles. So yeah, you mentioned the classic image of them hanging up in a loft space, and it's true for a few species, but our common pipistrelles, I don't think many people realise that they're crammed into cavity walls quite often in quite large numbers sometimes, you know, from kind of 50, 200 bats.
Certainly, as I stood there watching them last night with this Heath Robinson contraption we were using to record the noise, there must have been, I would have said, four dozen, possibly more bats came out, and they seem to have two exit points.
Right, yes, it can vary. You know, sometimes there only has to be one tiny gap. You know,
and it was a tiny gap.
Yeah, I mean, only about, you know, 15, 20 mil.
Yeah, that would be about right.
So they can have a variety of access points around the building. It could be under tiles, rotten wooden soffit boxes that they're getting in through there, missing mortar from bricks. They really are adaptable. They really are adaptable and, you know, started to use their buildings a lot more in recent times with the lack of tree roosts available.
Do they stay in the same place all year round?
No, so they actually have a whole network of roosts. And even in one summer, they can use a couple, maybe up to three or four even. They have their maternity roosts, which is female bats. May to September will gather and give birth to one pup each. And
well, you call them a pup?
Yes, yes. What I think is quite endearing and maybe hopefully changes people's opinion sometimes. Sky puppies is also what we mention sometimes, sky puppies, because they do look, they have wee dog faces sometimes. And then, you know, they'll have their mating roosts, which is completely different again. It could be more caves, trees, and, of course, hibernation. So hibernation, they need nice, cool, steady temperatures, high humidity. So, again, disused railway tunnels, disused mines. Pipistrelles are that funny bat where they'll actually, one individual bat could hibernate under a roof tile of someone's property over winter. So they really are everywhere. The more you look.
Absolutely. We've had them in the house a couple of times. I mean, the last time, there was something causing the light to flicker, you know, in the living room. And looked up, and suddenly I was alone in the living room. My wife was at the other end of the house shouting instructions as to how to deal with this problem. And basically, all I did was I just waited till it got tired. I waited till it got tired. It rested on one of the curtains, and very gently with a tea towel, picked it off and put it outside, and I just left it. So it could actually head off from there. Now, was that the right thing to do?
Yes, yes, on the whole it was, and you know...
on the whole, which bit did I get wrong?
I don't want to tell you done it wrong, because you did a great thing, you know, you looked after the bat and you got it back outside, what's ultimately what we want, you know. So the even easier way is sometimes turning off the light and opening the window as wide as you can, and they find their way out quite quickly, and that avoids the kind of need to pick them up then. It's not always a bad thing having a bat roost and eating all the insects at night. So,
well, exactly. How many midges can they get through in a night, pipistrelles?
Well, yeah, there's always that kind of figure that's thrown around, about 3,000 midges a night. I'm not really
sure.
That's
what I told my pal last night.
Well,
Leave them be.
So that's the kind of figure that goes around. I'm not sure how accurate it is, but they certainly do eat a lot of insects, because it's a lot of energy is burned up with them flying and echolocating, so they certainly need a lot of insect food.
Why do you like them so much?
Oh, it's the mystery around them, you know. It's my first experience of bats was seeing a roost emergence, and I would encourage everyone, you know, to get out and look for bats in the evening. It is fascinating to see them flying
when
around.
They all come out, basically.
Yeah, and I was testing them, like, go on, hit into me, and you know they wouldn't, because their echolocation is that good. In the split second, they avoid you and sweep round your head. And I guess I like the underdog as well, you know. I like promoting the animals that maybe aren't the cute and cuddly ones that we like, though I personally think they are quite cute and cuddly, but ones that, you know, have a lot of misconceptions about them, and I like hopefully changing some people's attitudes.
That was Liz Fennell there of the Bat Conservation Trust, and Liz was telling me that we can all take part in the National Bat Monitoring Programme, which helps them find out how bats are faring throughout the country. They're running a sunrise-sunset survey at the moment, and it's for anybody. No experience required. Just go outside for an hour at dusk or dawn and let them know if you see any bats. Even if you don't, that's still useful information for them, and you'll find a link on our webpage. We've got quite a lot of really sort of top-notch cooking going on at the moment.
I've never cooked an omelette on a fire before.
No, I'm telling you, and it's looking fab, because you've got chanterelle mushrooms, you've got red onion through that, you're just putting parsley across the top, your homegrown peas. That looked fabulous.
Well, yeah, I try my best.
And your best is very good indeed.
And I've also brought some jam as well, which is hedgerow jam, and that's a recipe that I got from a book by Fee Bird, Scented Forager, who's a regular correspondent to this programme. And it's very, well, I think it's yummy. Gooseberries, raspberries, meadowsweet.
We haven't got time to taste this, actually. I'm just going to finish briefly with Dennis Grattan. He says, for the most exciting of wild swimming, the Linnet Dee is spectacular with a depth of 7 metres and with a strong current. It's a challenge for competent swimmers, but only recommended for mask, snorkel and fins. Great suggestion, Dennis. There are umpteen other suggestions, but sadly we haven't got time for. In the meantime, from all of the team here at BBC Aberdeen, thanks very much for listening.